Friends Life Care, a subsidiary of Friends Life Care Partners, supports WHYY. Friends Life Care is a member organization designed for people who want to remain independent in their own home. Membership helps protect savings and prepare for unexpected changes in health. A plan is in place if care is ever needed. A nonprofit, Quaker-based organization since 1985, Friends Life Care offers educational seminars throughout the region. Details at friendslifecare.org.
When Pope Francis travels to Philadelphia for the World Meeting of Families in September, the visit will resonate beyond city limits. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Public safety officials throughout the region are preparing for those effects, and as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, one South Jersey county is planning for a strain on its transit system.
Camden County Director of Public Safety Rob Blaker says any major event in Philadelphia always has an impact on South Jersey.
Philadelphia and South Jersey are inexplicably linked on an everyday basis for a variety of reasons, including commuter and tourist travel, commerce, and emergency planning. And it will only intensify by dropping approximately 2 million people in the area during the World Meeting of Family Week.
Camden County is coordinating with other South Jersey counties and state and federal agencies, and officials are releasing some details on how to get around during the Pope's visit. They haven't said yet whether the Ben Franklin Bridge will remain open to vehicle traffic, but pedestrians will likely have access to the walkway. The PACO Speed Line, which runs through Camden County into Center City, will limit the number of open stations and sell only advance tickets for that weekend. DRPA Chief John Hansen says travelers can drive or get a ride to a PATCO stop, but your best bet is to walk.
The reports that I've received, this event is being described as a pilgrimage, which means expect to walk. And starting off walking to our station probably would be a great idea.
PATCO will have a capacity of 10,000 riders per hour, just a fraction of those expected to show up to see the Pope. For WHYY News, I'm Joe Hernandez.
The latest supermarket shakeup is underway for Philadelphia area shoppers. Let's fill our baskets with St. Joseph University professor and food industry analyst Richard George. Professor George, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Good evening. I'm happy to be here.
A&P filed for bankruptcy this week. I think they have almost 300 stores, and they say they're going to close 25 of them. Are they specifically in our area?
There are a number in the Philadelphia area, the ones that Acme or someone else does not pick up, they probably will close.
What are the implications for customers?
Well, I think for customers, I mean, first of all, unfortunately, A&P under the old Superfresh banner and Pathmark, they were just both very tired concepts. Matter of fact, when they announced that merger several years ago, I commented it looked like two giants wobbling toward insolvency. And unfortunately, that came to pass. I think shoppers are going to see better stores. Acme is on the rebound. I think Acme will clean them up. I think they'll provide the kind of pricing and the assortment that A&P at one time was known for. You know, a Wall Street Journal article back in the 40s said by 1951, every corner of America will have an A&P on it. So they were the kings at one time, and they got a little complacent. They lost sight of the customer. They didn't recognize the changing competition. And now this is their second and probably final bankruptcy.
Well, let's talk about that changing competition. When A&P and Acme ruled the supermarket world, there was scarcely any such thing as Trader Joe's, Whole Foods at one end, and Walmart and even Rite Aid's at the other.
That's right. I mean, it was even as recently as, let's say, a dozen years ago, maybe beginning of this century, the ones you mentioned weren't here. Aldi wasn't here. The dollar stores weren't major players. And Wegmans wasn't in the market. It's a very giant, was not as big a player here. It was a very, very different market when Acme ruled the world years ago and A&P was right with them. If you were a Philadelphia person, I grew up in Philadelphia, you shopped either at Acme or A&P, or as we say, Acme and A&P.
To what extent does this mirror a national trend, or is Philadelphia particularly saturated with competition?
Well, Philadelphia probably is overstored. The difficulty we have, as you mentioned, you have the Walmarts, the dollar stores, the Aldi on one end. You have Trader Joe's and Wegmans on the other end. And if you're an athlete today, you will be challenged because you're in the middle. What's your point of difference? Is it better quality, better service, better prices? And if it's not any of those things, it's hard to compete there. And then that giant who does a good job. So I think giant and athlete will occupy that so-called big middle, but I still think they're going to continue to be nibbled at by the people on the fringe. And as you mentioned, I mean, look at the amount of was available at a CVS and a Rite Aid and a Walgreens. So if you were, you know, an Acme or an AMP years ago, pretty much you could do business every day, Dave, by opening the doors. That's no longer good enough. You have to look at the changing consumer, you have to look at how the competitive array is changing. You look at technology. I mean, look at Amazon. You can purchase goods on Amazon online. I do a lot of work on millennials. I just did some research, a national sample. 24% of millennials say that they've shopped the last 30 days for food online, and only 56% of the same group has visited a supermarket the last 30 days. That's heretical. I mean, think it. National average of about 90 to 95% of us get to a supermarket once a month. This next generation is not going to shop in supermarkets. So there will be a lot of challenges going forward.
Is that where we're going in the future?
No, I think so, without a doubt. I mean, there's no reason. Think about it. Do we really need to walk into the ShopRite to inspect our Cheerios or Heinz ketchup? I mean, I see the day when, Dave, you're going to order all that online, and you're going to go to your local ShopRite. You're going to go inside with an empty cart. You're going to shop what we call the perimeter of the store now, which will be a bigger part of the store. You're going to buy, you know, the fresh fish and the meats, and you can buy the flowers for your wife and the cheeses, and then you're going to pull around back. You're going to load the Cheerios, the Heinz ketchup, and everything else that you bought, the bulky items, which you didn't need to shop for. Put that into your car, and you'll be on your way.
Professor, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Good luck, Dave. Take care. Bye-bye.
St. Joseph's University professor and food industry analyst Richard Jord.
The show is great. You know it's kind of funny how you get much more when you spend less money. Come share the proud new feeling. It's super fresh.
What happens when a city has too many charter schools? It's not a political question, but a practical one for the teachers, for the leaders of Wilmington, Delaware. The city's charter sector has exploded over the past decade. Competition for enrollment is so fierce that some schools are struggling to attract enough students. State officials think they have a solution, but it may change the very nature of school choice in the first state, as WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt reports.
The H. Fletcher Brown Boys and Girls Club is buzzing. It's a weekday afternoon here on Wilmington's east side, and children zip between rec rooms and study halls. Behind one door, a group of particularly boisterous girls play on a computer. I ask them where they go to school.
Coomba Academy.
I'm about to go to Cab
Carcroft Calloway. Elementary.
Stubbs Elementary.
East High Charter. I'm about to go to Cab Calloway.
Four kids, four different answers.
We probably have 9 or 10 different schools that Brown services.
Rachel Kane is executive director of the club. The kids here all come from the same relatively small neighborhood, but when the school day starts, they scatter.
I mean, there's only so many kids, and there's, I mean, at this point, a lot of choices.
Welcome to the school choice capital of Delaware. Within a square mile of Brown Boys and Girls Club, you'll find 10 different charter schools. Wilmington has 14 charters in all, accounting for just over half of the state's total. Philadelphia, which is 20 times the size of Wilmington, has just 6 times as many charters.
And now we've got such a concentration of charters in the city that in a sense they're kind of feeding off one another, and it's not clear that they are all viable.
Dan Rich teaches public policy at the University of Delaware and helps lead an advisory group formed last year by Governor Jack Markell to examine education in Wilmington. When he says the charters may not be viable, he means that literally. Over the last 2 years, the state has placed 5 charters on probation because of dangerously low enrollment numbers.
So I think we've reached a point where, even among charter advocates, that we're beyond saturation.
This spring, Rich's group urged state lawmakers to pass a moratorium on new charters in Wilmington, and they obliged. The moratorium will likely last a year, enough time for the state to create a strategic plan around what kind of new charters it authorizes, and more crucially, where it authorizes them. The plan ideally will work like this. Imagine I want to open an arts-oriented charter school in Wilmington. The state might look at its strategic plan and say, well, we already have a charter like that in the neighborhood you're proposing, but we do think there's a need in southern Delaware for that type of school. In other words, every new charter application will be cross-referenced with the strategic plan.
I think this new policy is very problematic.
Mike Petrilli is president of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, a conservative education think tank out of D.C.
Unfortunately, what we have seen for decades now is that decisions like these become very political, and interest groups do all they can to keep new schools from opening up in neighborhoods where there are other schools existing, not because of what's best for kids, but because of what they perceive as what's best for adults.
Plus, Petrilli says the whole concept stifles competition. What if that already existing art school in Wilmington was only mediocre? Shouldn't I be allowed to move in with my new school and jockey with them for students?
Here's the analogy. You know, if we allowed planning boards to try to protect stores like Walmart, and they did so by saying, well, we have a Walmart here, we're not going to allow a Target to move in across the street. Well, I mean, you can imagine that there'd be an outcry. Same thing here. You do not want to create a situation where there is a political body that is under political control, making decisions that may not be at the best interests of the consumers.
Dan Rich argues that charter schools aren't Walmarts. They're public schools funded largely with public money. It's the government's responsibility, therefore, to monitor them and determine where it wants to open them.
This is not the market model. This is public investment. We're making public investments in charters, if you look at the charter, to strengthen the overall public education system, not to find out if Fred or Harry can have a better Italian restaurant.
All this raises two basic questions. One, how much competition is good when it comes to charter schools? And two, should charters exist within the larger school system or outside it? As things existed before in Delaware, charters largely competed against one another in a quasi-free market. Once the strategic plan is in place, they'll function much more like traditional schools, only opening in areas where the government perceives a need.
This is Tariq.
How
this
are
is Avi.
Avi, nice to meet you.
That could ultimately make a big difference for kids like Tariq Turner. Turner is a regular at H. Fletcher Brown Boys and Girls Club. He just finished his 11th grade year at the Maurice J. Moyer Academic Institute, a charter school literally right next door to the Boys and Girls Club.
We have staff that's like really teaching on our sides, but this is going to be our last year open, so I won't be able to graduate from there, which sucks. So,
the state closed Moyer this June due to poor academic performance. Its enrollment was also falling. Now Turner will have to attend a low-performing public high school for his senior year.
I really wanted to graduate from Moyer. I really did, since I've been there since sixth grade, so.
When a private business competes and loses, it may stink for the investors and some people may lose their jobs. But when a charter school competes and loses, the consequences are different. The school closes. Kids' lives are disrupted. Lots of free market thinkers will say that's okay. In the long run, the kids are better off at a better school. The question is, does the long-term benefit outweigh the short-term pain? From the Delaware Desk, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
In today's headlines, President Barack Obama declares a major disaster in New Jersey after a storm battered the southern part of the state last month. Today's declaration means federal funds are available to state and local government to help rebuild and repair damage in Atlantic, Burlington, Camden, and Gloucester counties. Governor Chris Christie requested the aid last week and said the storm caused more than $15 million worth of damage and knocked out power to more than 300,000 residents. New Jersey's Board of Public Utilities approves two amendments to an earlier order authorizing South Jersey Gas's natural gas pipeline through the southern part of the state, including part of the Pinelands Preserve. One amendment states new customers cannot be connected to any portion of the pipeline in the preserved area. Another provides for moving a connecting station outside the preserve. 83 degrees, mostly clear skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:19. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Clear skies overnight, low humidity, a low of 65 degrees, and then sunny days tomorrow, Friday, and Saturday, high all 3 days in the mid-80s. Ahead to Sunday, intervals of sun and clouds, high again in the mid-80s. There's a 30% chance of late-day showers or thunderstorms. Still ahead, a new play in Chester aims to shine a light on the city's cultural assets.
More businesses, more activity downtown. It's a good thing.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival, a professional equity theater company north of Quakertown, presenting Shakespeare's Henry V, his party days behind him, a young king rallies the original band of brothers unto the breach. But at what cost to his land, his subjects, and his conscience? Shakespeare's Henry V, July 16th through August 2nd at Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival. For information, 610-282-WILL or pashakespeare.org.
This Week in This American Life. Yes, GM went bankrupt and has been losing customers to the Japanese for 25 years. But all the way back in 1984, one of its foreign competitors handed GM the secrets to making cars that were as reliable as the Japanese imports that have kicked their ass for decades. Why didn't GM take the advice? The amazing story of this place, NUMMI, a car plant that could have changed everything, this week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at karen.org. That's CARON.org.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. What's worse than discovering that your parked car has been towed? Being ripped off by the towing company for the privilege of picking it up. NewsWorks blogger Brian Hickey traveled to Camden to look into allegations of overcharging. And Brian, I understand you were in the services of a motorist whose 2010 Jaguar is still in the custody of Camden Towing Incorporated.
Yes, I was. I spent much of last week with a gentleman by the name of Troy Oglesby over in the city of Camden, and he was telling me a story about how his car got towed, namely that he was upset that he was getting charged $160 for the tow when $89 is the price of a tow in the city contract. So he is on a mission to kind of fix that situation for himself and others.
Was he able to find others who also endured extra fees?
He was able to find about five or six people over the course of the 2 days where I was with him that shared similar stories to what he told me.
Tell us more about this Mr. Oglesby. Apparently he was a write-in candidate at one time for mayor, a former Cherry Hill cop.
He ran for mayor back in the 90s after his brother was murdered. Then he is a Cherry Hill police officer who lost his job in a sort of controversial sense. He is co-owner of the Philadelphia Spirit, the ABA basketball team, American Basketball Association.
And he also had prior dust-ups related to parking when he was affiliated with one Donovan McNabb.
Yes, he was. He was a Donovan McNabb advisor and head of security, and there was a trial where Donovan's car was parked in a handicap spot, and he took the fall for that, saying that he was driving, not the old Eagles quarterback.
So back to this alleged infraction, to what extent were you able to also hear from the tow operator?
Well, I met the tow operator when Oglesby went over to the lot last Friday, and he claimed that the complainant is all wrong and that he's reading the contract right, and because flatbed towing was used, he's allowed to charge $160 a tow.
But it's discretionary on the part of the tow owner whether to call in that flatbed truck.
Well, yeah. Bill Hargrove, the owner of the tow company, told me that some cars, Oglesby included, can't be lifted off of the front like a normal tow truck would, so a flatbed has to be brought in. And in bringing that flatbed in, it costs a little more from them, so they're charging extra for that service.
Brian, this back and forth over the extra flatbed fee of $71 is certainly a matter of opinion. Ultimately, it's a matter of law.
While the city spokesperson said would only confirm that they are looking into it, city attorney Mark Rondino said that looking at the contract itself, they're not allowed to charge over $89. So I'm sure that will come up over the course of the investigation.
Is there a history of allegations of improprieties toward Mr. Hargrove?
To hear Hargrove tell it, no, that he's only gotten two complaints in recent months or years, and both times they were involving Mr. Oglesby, whose car was towed in May and then again in early July, which led up to this confrontation of sorts.
Take us through the path by which Mr. Oglesby also ran into frustrations trying to find relief or a path to relief through the legal system.
Well, we started with him showing me all of his receipts in the library in Camden, and then we drove over to City Hall, where he went to the city attorney's office and the purchasing department, and even to Mayor Dana Redd's office, seeking help, I guess is the best way to put it, and nobody was opening their doors to him that day. But then a couple days later, when he arranged for a protest at the lot itself, I called over to the city, and a spokesperson got back to me saying they have received his complaints and they're taking them very seriously. So that's where it stands today, is that City Hall over in Camden is looking into his allegations that Camden Towing is charging more than they should, not only to him, but to every car that they have charged $160.
Thanks, Brian.
No problem.
NewsWorks blogger Brian Hickey on NewsWorks Tonight. Members of Chester City Council gave up their seats of power today so that actors could perform a play in council chambers. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the play is a documentary about the hidden cultural assets of the troubled city in Delaware County.
This drumbeat introduced the Chester-made ensemble, four actors who read a play for the benefit of Chester City Council. The play is based on interviews with Chester residents. Lamar Todd and Don Newton explained that they took these people's cultural experiences and turned them into pinpoints on a map.
Instead of just creating a two-dimensional map based on research and surveys, we use storytelling and theater as a way to capture the data that will go on the map.
In this way, we were able to make community voices and experiences the heart of the map. Stories are data with soul.
The play and the map are the results of an 18-month project called Chester Made to find out what Chester has to offer culturally. Chester is a city in trouble, economically and in terms of crime. Much of the downtown is boarded up, and the presence of Harrah's Casino and the 5-year-old soccer stadium have done little to change that. The Chester Made project was done with the help of the Pennsylvania Humanities Council. Its director is Lori Zierer, and she says mapping the city's cultural assets is a way to make the city look different to both outsiders and to its residents.
At first, when we looked at a map to see where arts and culture happens, we saw only one or two places on the map. There's arts and culture in the very fabric of this community, and it has to come from the ground up to see what's really important and what people value.
The map includes a downtown art gallery, a video production company, a couple of small performance spaces, and a bronze foundry. It also includes things that stretch the definition of a cultural asset, including a juice bar and a donut shop. Fatso's Donuts was once featured on the Food Network show Save My Bakery. Its owner is Richard Wilcox, who would like to see the cultural assets map leveraged to rejuvenate the downtown.
More businesses, more activity downtown. It's a good thing. I mean, if you don't know what we have to offer, you would just breeze right on by.
The people behind the map hope this is only the beginning. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. A long-awaited report on the effects of Philadelphia's age-old practice known as councilmanic prerogative comes out tomorrow. We'll break down the numbers on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
People's Light presents the regional premiere of Bruce Graham's Stella and Lou, July 15th through August 23rd. On a quiet night in Lou's South Philadelphia bar, two lonely spirits arrive at a shared crossroad. This funny, wise, and tender love story is a portrait of a later-in-life friendship and taking the next step. For tickets, 610-644-3500 or peopleslight.org. People's Light supports WHYY.